chart. When the odds are saying you'll never win, that's when the grin should start. You gotta have hope. Mustn't sit around and mope. Nothing's half as bad as it may appear. Wait till next year and hope. When your luck is batting zero, get your chin up off the floor. Mister, you can be a hero. You can open any door. There's nothing to it but to do it. You gotta have heart. Miles and miles and miles of heart. Oh, it's fine to be a genius, of course, but keep that old horse before the cart. First, you gotta have heart.
A great slugger we haven't got.
A great pitcher we haven't got.
A great ball club we haven't got.
What do we got?
Idea.
We've got hope. We don't sit around and mope. Not a solitary sod do we eat, Mr. Cubs. We've got hope.
Boys, I'm proud of you.
We're so happy that we're humming.
That's the hardy thing to do.
Ho, ho, ho.
'Cause we know our ship will come in.
So it's 10 years overdue.
Ho, ho, ho. We've got heart. Miles and miles and miles of heart. Oh, it's fine to be a genius, of course, but keep that old horse before the cart.
So what the heck's the use of crying?
Why should we curse?
We gotta get better, 'cause we can't get worse.
And to add to it, we've got heart.
I used to say back in vaudeville, yazza, 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 yeah. Well, it's October the 3rd, 2017, and it's Tears Day. We got a half moon up there. I looked up there last night, it looked like it was more than a half moon. I don't know, maybe my Frank Silva memorial clock ain't working right again. It's supposed to give me all that stuff when the moon's right. All that's getting ready for Halloween, man. I'm going to go trick-or-treating to Washington, D.C., I think. Well, they're going nuts trying to figure out about this boy that shot up the town in Las Vegas. They really can't figure this out. They're combing every piece of paper he's got and all his files and all his history and interviewing all the people that ever knew him and everything. But the one thing they forget, the one thing they're missing, he was a lone wolf. They're missing that. Not to promote such a situation as that, but you got to admit, if we were a dictatorship takes over in this country, which it is very quickly, and we are shoved in a corner someplace, would be all right to have a few hundred people like that around. No wonder ISIS claims him. He did better than almost any ISIS guy did. Well, let's get back into this riot situation down through history. I don't think I read this to you lately, but this is called the Great Railroad Boycott. That got pretty hairy, man. The first nationwide railroad strike in 1877 began as a protest against a wage cut in Baltimore and involved many separate riots affecting various railroads, and it spread to the Pacific Coast. Before the strike ended, millions of dollars in property had been destroyed and more than 100 were dead. The next large strike of railway workers began similarly as a local union management struggle in the town of Pullman, Illinois, spreading until it covered two-thirds of the United States. The strike was astonishing, for at the time of the Pullman Palace Car Company enjoyed an excellent public image because of its model company town, Pullman, 12 miles south of Chicago Business District. The company, founded in 1867 by George Pullman, manufactured and operated under the contract both parlor and sleeping cars. In 1880, construction of the ideal community was begun, quote, to build it close proximity to the shops, homes for the working men, and such characters surroundings would prove so attractive as to cause the best class of mechanics to seek that place for employment in preference to others, unquote, and, quote, would result in a tendency towards continued elevation and improvement of the conditions not only of the working people themselves, but of their children growing up, unquote. A profit motive, however, was behind this utopian town, which was completed in 1884. All prices charged workers for rent, for gas and water, for merchandise in stores and the like were fixed so as to earn 6% on the company investment. Furthermore, the rents for the company homes were 20 to 25% higher than in Chicago and other neighboring communities. While not actually requiring to live in Pullman, workers were simply made to understand that those who did were more sure of steady employment with the company. The Pullman Company had never recognized a labor organization. Before 1893, unions of railroad workers were organized by types of work: locomotive engineers, firemen, trainmen, conductors, and switchmen, called brotherhoods. The need for a more inclusive single organization resulted in founding of the American Railway Union in the mid-1893. Eugene V. Debs, formerly of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen, became its president. Its growth was rapid. Within a year, the membership was greater than the combined brotherhoods. More than half of the 6,000 Pullman employers joined the ARU in its first year. The Depression of 1893 made it necessary for the company to lay off half the workers and to cut by 20% the wages of those kept on without any corresponding reduction in rents or other services to the workers. The consequences were disastrous. After the company had made its deductions, the average pay per worker was $6 a week, equal in purchase power to $24 today. Of course, this book was printed a long time ago, too. Yet the company continued to pay dividends, which were actually increasing. Particularly galling to the workers was the fact that the salaries of the officers and managers and top-level employees remained untouched. The festering discontent of the workers finally expressed itself in May 1894 when an employee committee requested that since business had improved, the old wage levels should be restored. The refusal was curt, and to show the management's displeasure with the chronic troublemakers, three of the committees were discharged on May 10th. More than half of the 6,000 Pullman employees joined the ARU in its first year. And I read that the Depression of 1893 made it necessary for the company to lay off half of the workers and cut by 20% the wages of those kept on, without any corresponding reduction in rents and other services. Now, I read that part, but I got called away. I get called away a lot. Do you ever have these honey-dos where you're right in the middle of something? Oh, man. That's life. That's what it's all about. Anyhow, the consequences were disastrous. After the company had made its deductions, the average per worker was $6 a week. I read that. I'll skip on down here. Sorry, boys and girls. I never promised you a rose garden. The festering discontent of the workers finally expressed itself on May 1894 when an employee committee requested that since business had improved, the old wage should be restored. The refusal was curt, and to show the management's displeasure with chronic troublemakers, that's you white working guys, three of the committees were discharged on May 10th. The Pullman workers in Chicago walked out on strike the next day and appealed to the ARU for support. The non-union workers were promptly laid off, and the plant was shut down. American Railway Union President Debs attempted without success to persuade the Pullman Company to arbitrate. Arbitrate with you crummy little white guys? We don't arbitrate with anybody. On June 26th, the union began a sympathetic boycott as 60,000 members of the Western Railway lines refused to handle Pullman cars. Pullman and all traffic from Chicago ceased. The boycott then spread slowly to the south and to the east so that the field of operations of the strike, originally only Chicago area, extended from the Allegheny Mountains to the Pacific Ocean. Now they got them by the balls. Chicago, however, became the central battleground, and the riots within the city were continuous and violent. Then, as now, Chicago was the most important, busiest railway center in the country. 24 lines terminated or centered in the city. Approximately 3,000 miles of railroad track were within its limits. The area was filled with yards, shops, roundhouses, signal towers, switching systems, all perfect targets for rioters bent on destruction. While the actual strike at Pullman began May 11th, there was no hint of trouble of any kind in Chicago until June the 27th, the day after the American Railway Union's boycott became effective. Prevent any passenger or freight trains from leaving or entering Chicago, the strikers uncoupled engines from the trains and the switchmen obstructed the main tracks with single cars or through switches so the trains would be shunted to dead-end sidings. The scab engineers and firemen were pulled from their cabs. Conductors were threatened with bodily violence. A few trains were derailed, further blockading traffic. These activities were mainly the work of the strikers, who were later to be joined by sympathizers in more destructive activities. For the next 4 days, the only riotous acts within the city limits were stone-throwing, hooting, and hissing at the non-union replacement scabs. All you young people out there, you don't know what a scab is, but any older guys out there know. In response to appeals from the General Railway Managers Association, an organization of Chicago lines, the city police were successful in preventing the assembly of any sizable group which might be bent on mob violence or demonstrating their civil rights. What civil right? However, outbreaks at Blue Island, an outlying village to the south, were very serious, and an uncontrolled mob was successful in halting the operations of the Rock Island line. Remember that song? Rock Island line? Rock Island line? I don't remember all the words. To protect railroad property, the Managers Association requested the United States Marshal in Chicago to appoint deputy marshals by the 1st of July, between 1,500 and 2,000 had been recruited. 1,500 and 2,000 recruited federal marshals. You see how the game is played, boys and girls? They were to be paid by the railroads and were company employees as well as United States peace officers. They throw that word peace around loosely. Even such large numbers, however, could not prevent the strikers' interference with the train movements. And by June the 28th, all 24 railroads were paralyzed. The introduction of these special deputies laid down the battle lines and was the signal for the beginning of violence. Freight cars were derailed, overturned, or burned in increased numbers. All freight as well as passenger traffic was halted. Supplies of meat from Chicago stockyards and great packing houses were ruined by the heat or stolen from the halted trains. No provisions were able to reach the city. An actual embargo upon the commerce of Chicago existed. From a legal standpoint, this was constituted interference with interstate commerce. Now, they came out with that act, that law. Interstate commerce, that's one of the most dangerous laws to working people that ever was put into action. And any time the FBI or anybody else wants to go after you, they charge you with going against interstate traffic, interstate commerce. You'll see that come up in court all the time. Just like the FBI uses it for somebody who commits a crime and then goes from one state to the other over the border. The United States mail was also tied up. Mail cars were idle. The United States mail was also tied up. Mail cars were idle. The Attorney General Richard Olney accordingly began to lay the groundwork for government action against the strikers and the boycotters. In other words, the people. Olney felt that vigorous federal interference in Chicago, the origin and the center of the strike, would prevent its spread over the entire country. One of the many accusations made by the union following the strike was that the government's first act in Chicago was a definite alliance with the railway interests. Guess what? For Olney was a railroad lawyer and a member of the board of several lines. The authorization to employ deputies was the first step. Olney said, quote, "But the true way of dealing with the matter is by force, which is overwhelming and prevents any attempt at resistance," unquote. Well, the result was a first in history of America. Labor, the issuance of a federal injunction to stop a labor dispute. The Attorney General explained the basis of the order. Quote, "A railway is not a mere private enterprise. It is a public highway. Any obstruction in the highway can be dealt with by federal authorities as a restraint of commerce." There you go. You know that some of those laws there were charged with against the order, interstate commerce. If you read the legal details of the trial, you'll find that in the order trial. Employees who quit work on highways are in reality obstructing it. They can be dealt with as a conspiracy in restraint of trade. The interference with the mails was a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. You see how they use it against the workers and not the big shots? Antitrust is supposed to be against the big boys that are doing illegal things, not the workers. Two federal judges in Chicago accordingly issued an injunction on Monday, July 2nd, ordering all persons to refrain from interfering or stopping any of the business of any of the railroads in Chicago engaged in as common carriers. When federal agents went to the Blue Island to read the injunction to a crowd of from 2,000 to 3,000 who had their morning blocked in the Rock Island tracks, they were jeered at. The exhilarated crowd yelled, "To hell with the government! To hell with the court!" When some of the mob threw themselves in front of an engine to stop its progress, the deputy marshals opened fire. The ensuing affray resulted in the stabbing of one marshal and the wounding of several others. When this defiant outburst was reported to President Grover Cleveland, he accepted his Attorney General's suggestion and ordered federal troops to Chicago. Neither the governor of Illinois nor the mayor of Chicago was consulted on this move. They just did it. The first troops numbered 500, arriving at Chicago on July 4th. Because of the increased tenseness of the strike, people began to gather on the railroad property out of curiosity to see what might happen. The later federal investigation noted that there was seldom any purpose or leadership in the mobs. Most of the destruction, the report stated, was done wantonly and without premeditation. Oh, that's looking at it from the company point of view. As in most riots, many hoodlums and young boys were among the most active. In Chicago, a large number of women participated also. That's an interesting word, hoodlum. Very interesting. Because if you resist the federal government in any way and the money power in this country, you're automatically a hoodlum or a terrorist. Because of the dense mass of men, women, and children blocking the way, half a battalion of the first soldiers from nearby Fort Sheridan found it necessary to advance to their duty post in the Union stockyards on the evening of their arrival with rifles leveled and revolvers ready. That's where I got mustered out of the Army, is Fort Sheridan. They tried to convince me to re-up for another 3 or 4 years. I said, you got to be kidding. Well, you can, with the money we'll give you bonus, you can buy a new car, Tom. Oh, yeah. And I can go to Vietnam and get my ass blown off, too. In spite of their vigilance while guarding railway personnel and clearing the tracks to restore service, trains were uncoupled, many by women. Cars were derailed, Pullmans were sidetracked, and several freight cars were burned that evening. It's very interesting how much white women have been involved in some very heavy fighting for the working class, just like they were under the Vikings. Because of many separate tracks and yards scattered on the south side of the city, the limited number of troops could not control the many separate mobs who might easily overturn and burn cars in one spot and disperse before the police or soldiers could arrive. They call these mobs. Well, I call them companies of workers, you know. July 5th asked Governor John Altgeld, I wonder about that. I've known some Altgeld people in Indiana. They're Germans. I think my stepfather had people from the Altgeld family. To send immediately to Chicago such state militia, National Guard troops as were available, to aid in suppressing and preventing continued violence to persons and property. Not that the government troops weren't doing the same thing to the workers. The governor immediately ordered 2,000 of the militiamen to the city. Within 2 or 3 days, more than 4,000 were on active duty. Now you see, all they had to do to get around and stop this is give the guys a reasonable wage. Bring the wage back up to what it was before the Depression. You see, they could have had no, there wouldn't have been any property damage, no cars would have been destroyed. But these big shots, these fat cats, assholes, they won't make a deal for a dime. And so the workers don't have any choice. On the 5th of July, large crowds roamed almost at will, pushing over freight cars, setting a few of them on fire, throwing switches, stoning trains, and burning signal towers. And my father used to work in a signal tower in Warsaw, Indiana. These were the guys, before there was automated gates, they'd let see the train coming, they'd get a signal, and they'd let down the gates, and then they'd pull the gates back up when the train went through town. At one spot, the soldiers dispersed a huge crowd at bayonet point. In the evening, at the stockyards, the crowd was estimated to number 10,000. No firearms were used because such orders had not yet been issued. The commanders were sensibly waiting developments. During the evening of the 5th, a colossal fire engulfed the buildings of the 1892 World's Columbian Exposition at Jackson Park. The overworked fire department was being summoned here and there, where freight cars were ablaze and seven buildings were reduced to ashes before the conflagration was brought under control. As you can see, the tremendous property damage was all a result of simply not giving them a decent wage, the workers a decent wage. Though the blaze was undoubtedly the work of an incendiary, the citizens, encouraged by the newspapers, quite naturally assumed that the strikers, or at least their sympathizers, were the guilty ones. You see, the federal government, if they were going to be for the people, could have stepped in and forced the company to raise the wages back to what they were. They're not asking for more and more. They're asking for just what they had before. The peak of destruction was reached on Friday, July 6th, when the mobs destroyed railroad property valued at $340,000, more than $1,250,000 at today's values. By this time, hundreds of freight cars, which had been stopped on various tracks, were grouped together in an individual company yard where they could be more easily guarded by both federal soldiers and state militiamen. And think what it's cost the taxpayers for all these federal troops. These yards were in the southern section of the city, generally removed from any concentrations of buildings or houses, but the very extent of the long rows lining the tracks of various sidings made car-to-car guarding impossible and led to a carnival of incendiarism. The axle boxes of freight cars were filled with greasy rags, waste. Anyone could secrete himself between or in the cars when a guard passed, then remove this waste, apply a match, and possess an ideal torch. Because the day was breezy, it was not even necessary to set each car on fire. The wind would fan the flames through the tightly packed cars, since the fire hoses could seldom reach the lines of flames. Complete destruction was achieved with a minimum of activity. That's a note to lone wolves. The mob became observers, encouraging and cheering the relatively few actual fire setters. Those at the Chicago Central Yards within the city limits were particularly vengeful because one of the country's agents had shot and seriously wounded two trespassing rioters at the stockyards the night before. The great destruction of the freight cars in a single yard took place on this Friday evening when fires destroyed more than 700 cars at Panhandle Yards at 50th Street in South Chicago. The yard was one of the largest, 2 miles long and half mile wide, and the tracks were packed solidly with freight cars. The surrounding rural area was completely open, with no fences, no barriers or buildings. For some reason, never explained, only a token force of soldiers and militiamen had been assigned there. Because of its isolation, no hydrants were installed along the tracks. The rioters found in it an unparalleled opportunity for unimpeded destruction. The mob there was said to have numbered 6,000. Well, the concept of the rioting workers was right. Destroy the toys of the rich, the bastards. Destroy their toys. You know, whether it be their trains or their houses or their airplanes or whatever. And I always said that's where most revolutionaries make a mistake, by singling out people who don't have really anything to do with it and killing them, beating them, or even killing one guy who runs the company. I mean, there's all kinds of hundreds of guys who run these companies, but they're very jealous of their property and their goody, their jaguars and so forth. So you got to know what to go after to hurt them. The Chicago Inter-Ocean reported the successful activity of the mob. Quote, from this moving mass of shouting rioters, squads of dozen or two departed running towards the yards with firebrands in their hands. They looked like the gleaming like specters, their lighted torches bobbing about like will-o'-the-wisps. Soon, from all parts of the yard, flames shot up and billows of fire rolled over the cars, covering them with the red glow of destruction. The spectacle was a grand one. Before the cars were fired, those filled with any cargoes were looted. The people were bold, shameless, and eager in their robbery. It was pandemonium let loose, and fire leaping along for miles, and men and women dancing with frenzy. Must have been a good time. It was mad scene, where riot became wanton, and men and women became drunk on their excesses. Well, what drove them to that? What drives people to that kind of thing? The light of dawn showed long, continuous rows of blackened wheels and undercarriages, and tracks twisted and broken by the intense heat. Up to this time, most of the casualties had been inflicted by the federal marshals and troops. During this Friday, the state militiamen began pouring into the city in response to Governor Altgeld's call. You see how they always go with the rich and powerful, these politicians. Well, they owe their whole career and their whole position to those people. So obviously, so you know from the beginning, when you go to war with the system, you know who you're going to war with. There's no kidding anybody. They were scattered in small companies for the purpose of clearing the tracks, protecting railroad property, and restoring order. The action participated the most violent encounter of entire Chicago strike period, while furnishing protection to the wrecked train on the Grand Trunk Line at 49th and Loomis Streets on the afternoon of July 7th, a company of Illinois National Guard was attacked by an angry mob. Yeah, a contemporary account again in Inter-Ocean describes the encounter. Quote, 7,000 people had been following the train, and as their number increased, many became bolder. Approaching Loomis Street, the train halted to raise a car which had been overturned. The crowd hooted and swore at the soldiers, throwing stones and bricks. A few shots were fired. After warning the crowd to disperse, the commander ordered his troops to load their rifles. For the moment, this seemed like a salutary effect, causing a few women and children to leave, but in reality generating an uglier spirit among the rioters. The hail of stones continued without interruption. And as I say over and over again, all the company had to do was give these people their wages back the way they had them before that depression at that time. All they had to do was give them their regular wages. A bayonet charge was immediately ordered, during which some rioters were severely wounded. However, this cleared the railroad right away. More determined than ever to resist the progress of the train, the mob returned. Some of them rushed forwards and upset a flat car which had been righted. Do you realize how much muscle it takes to tip a freight car over or a flat car? Those damn things are god-awful, I mean, super heavy. And to have enough rioters to tip them over was something else. I don't see how that many people could get their even get their hands on the thing. More missiles were hurled and some shots fired by the rioters. Why don't they call them labor soldiers? Four soldiers had already been severely wounded and their lieutenant injured in the head by a stone. No reinforcements had appeared. The situation was perilous. There seems to have been no alternative left to the commanding officer except to order his men to fire at will and to make every shot count. In other words, kill every working person he can, including the women and children. They had no other choice. They never have any other choice, just like at Kent State. The several volleys of the soldiers killed four and wounded 20 rioters. Some of the latter were women. The stunned crowd was dispersed by the city police in a series of charges and withdrawn revolvers, but without the firing of another shot. The Loomis Street confrontation marked the peak of the Chicago violence. It was also another tragic landmark in the history of American labor, the first time the United States troops fired on workers. I don't think so. I think they'd fired on workers many times before, if you'll check the history. Because of the continued outbreaks of violence, President Cleveland was pressed to declare martial law when all else fails. This he hesitated to do. Yeah, right. Instead, of on July 8th, he issued a proclamation to the people of Illinois and Chicago in particular, warning them that those taking part with a riotous mob in forcefully resisting and obstructing the execution of the laws cannot be regarded otherwise than as public enemies. So the working class became public enemies just for wanting a few pennies. This is like in the movie Fist when Rocky meets up with the head of the company and he's sitting at the table and he says, "We're going to cut them off." And the guy says, What did you say?" He said, "Your balls, we're going to cut them off." Only the Chicago phase of the nationwide strike has been discussed here, but violence was everywhere. In Illinois, in Indiana, Iowa, Oklahoma, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and California. The boycott did not affect the Northeast because Pullman did not hold contracts with those railroads. 16,000 soldiers were stationed throughout the country at the height of the strike, and terror tactics were frequent, though not as such a vast and destructive scale as in Chicago. The Pullman strike and its resulting national boycott have been called an almost unparalleled labor upheaval, with all union members standing solidly together to cripple the operations of their employers. Seldom have multiple mobs been so destructive in fighting the enemy, in this case the railroad managers, only to lose the battle in the end. The losses to the railroads totaled over $5 million, including property damage and loss of earnings. The strikers forfeited almost $1.5 million in wages. Eugene Debs and his American Railway Union fared badly at the time. Railroad detectives prevented his organized activities, and recognizing defeat, the ARU was organized in 1897 for political action as the Social Democratic Party, the forerunner to the Socialist Party of America. The investigation of the causes of the strike by the United States Strike Commission made recommendations for improving labor relations in the railroad industry. Yeah, just raise their wages. Give them the wages, asshole. But the managers failed to agree on many of them. Of course not. Worst of all to George Pullman was the liquidation of his beloved model town into an ordinary factory town. And that's the end of that riotous situation where primarily white people rose up and took on the big boys. I want to tell you something, that if such a situation would arise again, almost all these conservative right-wing Republicans would side with the system and the rich guys. Remember that, no matter how rotten the Democrat Party is, the big shots would control the situation, and the right-wing conservative types would go along with it. I saw it in Indiana how they manipulated the white workers into voting for the right-to-work cheap law in Indiana. And they're paying for it, too. They think they're gaining some, but they're going to lose in the end. I know all about that right-to-work committee. When I worked for Douglas Aircraft, I was involved at first in supporting those people. But I discovered what they were, and I quit. And then I was offered a union position. I forget what they call them, managers or whatever. But I really didn't want to get involved in anything. I'm too much of a hardhead. I can't agree with anybody all the way. So that puts me more or less a philosophical outlaw.
Stumble from my good warm bed Monday morning, oh my head. Gotta go and do it all again. Wake up, baby, rise and shine. It's coffee, eggs, and bacon time. Walk your working man out to the car. The boss is in his usual mood. Not one thing does he approve. Sometimes you can't keep him satisfied. Up and down the assembly line, worried faces much like mine, showing the wear and tear in their eyes. They're making it hard on the working man, trying to make a living any way he can. Making ends meet on the installment plan, his money goes right. Heaven help him if you think you can. They're making it hard on the working man. Big policeman in his prime sits behind his billboard sign, aims his radar gun right straight at me. A letter from the IRS said, boy, your taxes are a mess. Is this the way the good life's supposed to be? They're making it hard on the working man, trying to make a living any way he can. Making ends meet on the installment plan, his money goes right. Heaven help him if you think you can. They're making it hard on the working man. Stumble from my good warm bed Monday morning, oh my head. Gotta go and do it all again. In the Frigidaire, the kids all need new shoes to wear. Payments laid on my old truck again. They're making it hard on the working man, trying to make a living any way he can. on the installment plan. His money goes right through his hand. Heaven help him if you think you can. They're making it hard on the working man. They're making it hard on the working man. Trying to make a living any way he can. Making ends meet on the installment plan. His money goes right through his hands.
Well, I'm going to close out here with a short talk by Harry the Horrible. You know him, Harry the Horrible, about the Las Vegas situation. Going to be an interesting next few days. Funny how no one from the hotel has been interviewed yet. Quote, "Hello, front desk, there's some machine guns going off next door. Could you tell him to keep it down? I'm trying to watch Will and Grace," unquote. "Show us the hallway security footage and the elevator footage since the 28th. Show us something pertinent. There's almost as many cameras in Las Vegas as there are lights. Did the glass from the windows hurt anyone? Interview housekeeping. Quote, did you see 15 weapons when you were cleaning the room?" Unquote. You can't hide that much ammo and weapons in a hotel suite that an astute maid will not see. Notice how many times the media has screamed lone wolf in the past 18 hours. Whenever they start yelling something, I start thinking in the opposite direction and look at the target, a bunch of mostly white people flying American flags. As in all criminality, you must always look at who benefits. I don't think the public is so fish-eyed anymore, especially the victims, who are practically all pro-NRA people and will perhaps really scrutinize the coming legislation that we will all know will ensue. And that's from Horrible Harry.
I might comment that it takes more than a cowboy hat to make a white separatist. Remember, even a slave has a job. A job. You're asking for wages. Not a job. Well, that's about it today, boys and girls. I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day, Dave Lane's favorite day.
Fight the traffic once again. Driving down the interstate, my tension eases as the traffic thins. And I leave my worries far behind and wonder what the in crowd might be doing. Farther down the road, a pretty woman's waiting with a drink for me. There's a lot of woman there, and pretty soon that's where I'm gonna be. I'm the only one that's missing. I'm the one the in crowd's waiting for. And I drive around the back and leave the car. Then I open up the door. And there's